We move to the fourth case, this morning, U.S. versus Hampton.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, the district court's decision should be vacated for two reasons. First, the district court erred in entering into evidence statements illegally obtained from Mr. Hampton in violation of his right to counsel. Second, the district court erred when it found Mr. Hampton's prior conviction for insulting or provoking contact battery to be a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act. For these reasons, Mr. Hampton's conviction should be vacated and remanded for retrial, or in the alternative, his sentence should be vacated and remanded for resentencing. The district court erred in entering Mr. Hampton's statements into evidence at his trial because the interrogating officers violated his right to counsel. The sole issue is whether he unambiguously invoked his right to counsel during the tape-recorded portion of his interrogation. The government discusses the interrogation.
You're not relying on the pre-recording interchange, are you?
Correct.
Okay.
Because that portion of his interrogation is not relevant to whether he later unambiguously invoked his right to counsel.
Well, he did and he didn't.
He did, though, when he said, in response to the question, would you like an attorney? He responded, or would you like to have counsel present? He said, yeah, I do, but you, and then was interrupted by the interrogating officer. At that point, when he said, yeah, I do, that was an unambiguous request for counsel. Now, the government argues that the use of the word but there somehow creates an ambiguity where otherwise it was an unambiguous request for counsel.
This wasn't his first time around the block, was it?
Correct. He had previously been in...
And he thought he could maybe get a better deal if he kept talking, right?
We don't know what he thought because he was interrupted. He said the word but, and I think it creates extremely dangerous precedent for this court to hold that the use of the word but somehow turns... And when you're interrupted by an officer, creates an opportunity for that officer to create ambiguity where none would exist otherwise. We don't have to speculate. All that's required is a request that... A reasonable police officer would understand to be a request for an attorney. We don't have to speculate because these officers confirmed back to Mr. Hampton four times that he had asked for an attorney. The case law is clear. The officers were required to cease questioning Mr. Hampton once he unambiguously invoked his right to counsel, and they are prohibited from clarifying his otherwise unambiguous request. The district court also erred in sentencing Mr. Hampton under the Armed Career Criminal Act because he does not have three prior violent felonies. His 1999 aggravated battery conviction for insulting or provoking contact is not a violent felony under either Supreme Court or Seventh Circuit precedent. Under the Armed Career Criminal Act, a violent felony is either the use or attempted use of physical force or one of the enumerated offenses, burglary, arson, extortion, or the use of explosives, or an act that otherwise presents a serious risk of physical injury to another. That's the residual clause. And as the government conceded at trial, that's the only way that the crime at issue here could possibly be a violent felony. The court, in interpreting whether a crime is a violent felony, applies the categorical approach, in which it looks only to the generic elements of the offense, or how it is ordinarily committed, and not the specific facts of the crime. In Illinois, the crime that Mr. Hampton was convicted of is battery, which is defined as, one, either bodily harm battery, or that is battery that causes bodily harm, or two, battery by insulting or provoking contact. Mr. Hampton was convicted of this latter type of battery of an insulting or provoking nature. Under Begay, it is clear that to be a violent felony under the residual clause of the Armed Career Criminal Act, a crime must be both purposeful, violent, and aggressive, and similar in kind as well as degree of risk posed to the enumerated offenses. Insulting or provoking battery clearly does not meet this standard. Illinois follows the common law rule. Any contact, however slight, may constitute battery. And this court has even found itself in Garcia Meza. acts criminalized under the statute include very minor contact with virtually no risk of causing injury, such as throwing juice or milk at somebody, poking somebody, spitting on somebody. And again, in Garcia Meza, this very court characterizes conduct as small potatoes. Now, this simple battery becomes aggravated battery when an aggravating factor is present, such as the status of the victim, so a police officer, a teacher, a cab driver, or the location of the offense, such as a public place. But this doesn't change the basic fact that the minor touchings criminalized by this offensive contact battery are nothing like the enumerated offenses, burglary, arson, extortion, or the use of explosives, nor do they otherwise present a serious risk of physical injury as they're required to by Begay under to be a residual clause violent felony under Begay. As this court previously found in Evans, for example, this insulting and provoking contact battery, which became aggravated in that case because the victim was pregnant, did not change the fact that the conduct at issue, insulting or provoking battery, was not sufficient to meet Begay.
I think the argument is that the status of the victim in this subsection of the statute, which is to say a police officer, is qualitatively different than the status of the victim in the Evans
Correct.
Case, which was a pregnant woman.
Correct.
Which is to say in the law enforcement context you're likely to provoke a violent struggle.
In response to that, I would say two things. First, police officers are trained generally to defuse situations nonviolently. I would say more so than somebody possibly responding to a pregnant woman being the victim of insulting or provoking battery. Secondly, this court held in Johnson that no matter what the aggravating factor is, this doesn't change the basic conduct at issue, the nature of the conduct at issue, which is offensive or provoking contact, offensive battery, and even in Evans, this court said spitting on someone is the usual example that is a crime that amounts to battery under this statute. And as this court recently held in Sonnenberg, which the government cited, even if a crime could theoretically involve more aggressive conduct in limited circumstances, the sweeping breadth of a statute across minor, nonviolent crimes prevents it from qualifying as a violent felony because it doesn't meet the standard in the typical case. That's exactly the issue, the case with this, the statute at issue here. In that case, it was criminal sexual abuse, and the court found it wasn't a violent felony because the statute included sexual activity that could be consensual and nonviolent, so it didn't meet the gay's purposeful, violent, and aggressive standard in the typical or ordinary case. As the Supreme Court also recently held in a separate Johnson case, in that case, although it considered the physical force prong, it did discuss the definition of violence, which is not part of either prong. Instead, it's part of the greater section, which is the parent section, violent felony. And it said this violence connotes a substantial degree of force. And it's hard to see how a conviction for a very similar crime in Florida could not be violent under that prong, but it could be violent under the residual clause. In conclusion, we respectfully request that Mr. Hampton's conviction be vacated and remanded for retrial, or in the alternative, vacated and remanded for resentencing. Unless there are any questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
You may. Thank you.
Good morning. Joe Hartzler on behalf of the United States.
Good morning.
I'd like to mostly talk about the second issue, but I don't want to shortchange the first issue, so let me just make three very quick points. First of all, you'll notice in the first seven or thereabout minutes of the recorded conversation, it really does not qualify as interrogation in terms of an effort to elicit incriminating statements. It's simply to clarify whether or not he wants counsel. The second thing, in our brief, we cite both Davis and Lee in the leaf of this court, Davis of the Supreme Court, in the legal framework, but I don't think I really emphasized those in the argument. And if you'll review this court's decision in Lee and in Davis, It defines what constitutes good police practice, and I believe that's exactly what happened here. The police officers were re-invited to continue the interview, and he made an ambiguous statement, and they tried to clarify it, and ultimately he waived his Miranda rights. And then finally, before you would rule against the government in this case, I would urge you to listen to the tape. I think you'll find that the police officers acted in a very professional manner. It was exceedingly cordial conversation. So if there are no questions about the first
Actually,
issue.
Actually, there are, Mr. Hartzler.
Yes. I'm
concerned, given the way your argument works, about how well it reconciles with the Supreme Court's decision in Smith, which, if I understand it correctly, says that we cannot use that after you get an unambiguous request for counsel, such as, yeah, I do, you can't use further interrogation or questioning to cast doubt, to create ambiguity in what was a clear request.
Well, I think that it obviously, if you're interpreting this as an unambiguous assertion of his right to counsel, then the questioning should cease. But our position is, and I think that in listening to the recording and looking at the transcript, frankly, you'll see that there was not clarity, and as the district court found, it was not a clear and unambiguous assertion of his right to counsel. He was fishing for a deal, and I think that's perfectly clear.
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Right. Well, but that is the overlay of what's going on, so I think it's fair to say that at the point he made any statement, the statement that was interrupted, he wasn't finished with that statement, there was an ambiguity that the officers tried to clarify.
Well, what's the ambiguity but for the interruption?
No, he started to say, but.
And maybe he was going to say, but I don't know how to pay for one. Who knows where that was going?
Well, that's why.
But by cutting it off, he was in essence denied the opportunity to create an ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. I think I understand your point. Can I suggest that in looking at the first 7 minutes of the recording or listening to the first seven in the transcript, I think it's pretty clear what he's trying to do. He's trying to feel out the officers to determine whether or not his continuing to talk to them will be of some benefit. That's what's going on here. I mean, this is...
I don't doubt that.
Yeah. Well, then the question is whether or not, in the context of that statement, this judge erred in concluding that it was an ambiguous statement that the officers had the right to clarify. And I would urge you defer to the district court's judgment in listening to the officer's testimony, listening to the entire recording, and concluding that this was an ambiguous statement that the officers exercised good police practice in their effort to clarify the statement, which I think is consistent with what Davis and this court in Lee recommend. So I hope I've answered your question. I'll move on.
I understand that's your answer, and we'll move on.
So. Okay. On the second issue, the parties differ, I think, on primarily the import of this court's decision in Evans. And my worthy opponent's position is that Evans shuts the door on an insulting and provoking physical contact crime. And then they cite to Sherman Johnson, where we had the government conceded that it could not distinguish a battery in a public way. But even in Sherman Johnson, which was disposed of in a non-precedential way, and certainly more so in Evans, this court has indicated that what we look at is how the crime is generally committed. I think that in Sherman Johnson, the court refers to in the ordinary case. Well, if you look at the Illinois aggravated battery statute, there are a list in the current statute, I think the number is something like 23. It's in the appendix of the defendant. The 23 various aggravating factors, and there's a pretty wide variety. Well, when this court said we would conclude that insulting and provoking physical contact is not a crime of violence unless, with an exception, if it's generally committed to be violent, aggressive, and purposeful. Well, if you look at the numerous factors in the Illinois statute. There's one, I think, that leaps out. And by the way, it's not still in the statute, but it was at the time of his conviction. They changed the statute in 2005, withdrew the peace officer. But of all those factors, what is the one that you would say, well, this certainly looks like the most serious aggravated factor offense? And it's this one. That's why the government takes a different position than it took in Sherman Johnson, because this case is distinguishable from Evans. Evans created an exception for this kind of case, and I think there are a variety of reasons that this falls within the exception. It's far closer to a burglary-type offense than a battery of a pregnant woman or battery on a public way is. It has the same kind of danger involved. It necessarily involves some sort of confrontation, as is not the case in a variety of the other insulting and provoking cases. There is, in every situation where there's a battery on a police officer, a serious potential risk of physical injury. I think also that it's similar to the enumerated offenses, such as burglary, fleeing cases that this court has decided in Welch and in Sykes. It's before the Supreme Court now. All of those cases involve some very clear, boldly defiant behavior. And that's what an assault on a police officer involves. You know, someone who assaults a pregnant woman, you could characterize them more as a coward than as a bold individual, whereas someone that assaults a police officer is defying that officer's lawful authority. And bear in mind, in a pregnant woman or a public way, there's no provision that the person has to be executing their official duties. This is a peace officer. We're talking about an assault on a peace officer, which the statute defines as somebody that can make arrests. And it has to be a peace officer that's executing their official duties.
Mr. Hartzler, one of my concerns about that argument is that if I understand this correctly, the peace officer is entitled immediately to arrest the person who assaulted him, right?
I believe that's correct.
Is the officer legally authorized at that point to use deadly force?
No.
Surely not.
Yeah.
And presumably even before using lower levels of force that we know police officers are authorized to use to carry out arrests, there would need to be some kind of physical resistance that would escalate the situation further. Would you agree?
Probably.
And that, frankly, leads me to wonder, as stupid as it may be, as foolish, I wouldn't say bold, maybe, but at least foolish, to assault a police officer in this manner, I frankly have trouble with the idea that the insulting behavior of spitting on a police officer or poking him with a finger is violent within the meaning of the Armed Career Criminal Act.
We're not even arguing whether spitting or poking the finger is. The issue is whether or not the offense as generally committed, and if it's generally committed as spitting or poking a finger at a police officer, which are within the statute, I'm not disputing that. Mm-hmm. The question is, and I think Sonnenberg indicates that the court should use its common sense, where we are forced to engage in armchair empiricism. I mean, let's face it, on these residual offenses. I didn't hear you.
It's the best we can do.
That's the best we can do. And I think you'll find that in all the residual clause offenses, we're not going to likely have data that's going to resolve the issue. And mm-hmm. we presented some statistics. My opponent has pointed out some of the weaknesses of those. I mean, we provided them to give the court some foundation, some sense of the risk of physical injury in these cases. But I would readily concede, if this crime is generally committed by spitting or poking a finger, it's not a violent crime.
How do you think it's generally committed?
Well, I think it's generally committed by young men. I would guess that a large percentage probably involves alcohol. And I think it's generally a violent physical confrontation.
I mean, is it a punch? Is it
punch? This case, for example, was a thrust to the chest somehow, pushed the
push a cop away?
Push, I think a previous offense where it was a bodily injury, was he kicked the police officer, I believe. Yeah, I think if you look even at the cases, you'll find that with peace officers, with police officers, it's generally that sort of thing. Yes, I see that my time is up. I'm concerned that I haven't addressed all your questions, but thank you very much.
Okay. No doubt we'll have more for you in the later cases. So.
Your Honors, I'd just like to address a couple of the points relating to the sentencing issue. Mr. Hartzler argues that in the ordinary case, this same crime when committed when the victim is a police officer somehow involves different conduct than that the court, this court has previously identified as the general way in which this crime is committed, yet he presents no evidence for that. In fact, this court in the Garcia Meza case did present a hypothetical, which was you could crumple up a parking ticket, throw it on a police officer's shoe. That's aggravated battery. And in several of the cases in Illinois, I believe it was Bracey and De Rosario, the conduct involved there with aggravated battery of a police officer was throwing milk at the police officer, throwing juice at them. There's nothing that indicates that this crime is categorically more violent when it's committed against a peace officer.
There's a separate provision of the statute for bodily harm.
Correct, yes.
Battery of a police officer.
Correct. And Mr. Hartzler as well discussed that, just now talked about kicking somebody, but that falls under the bodily harm prong of this. It's not insulting or provoking contact, and that's all that's at issue in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.